Welcome to the Standing Up to POTS podcast, otherwise known as the POTScast. This podcast is dedicated to educating and empowering the community about postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, commonly referred to as POTS. This invisible illness impacts millions, and we are committed to explaining the basics, raising awareness, exploring the research, and empowering patients to not only survive, but thrive. This is the Standing Up to POTS podcast.
Hello, fellow POTS patients and magnificent people who care about POTS patients. I'm Jill Brook, your hyperadrenergic host, and today we have an interview with an amazing woman, Christy Cox, who has done so many incredible things. First of all, she wrote the best-selling book, Holding It All Together When You're Hypermobile. Second, she is the person behind the monthly newsletter at edsshare.com. and the Living Library at EDS 411, and she'll talk all about that. And more recently, in the POTS world, she has written an incredible article about how to tell the difference between anxiety and POTS, and what happens when your POTS gets mistaken for anxiety. And unfortunately, this is something that Christy knows about firsthand. So I'm so excited to have you here today, Christy. Thank you for being on our podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Jill. I'm so appreciative for the opportunity to be able to talk with you and your listeners. And, you know, I'm so grateful for what all you do for the community, both in your site, in your nonprofit, and the resources that you are a kind of like me, a fellow patient who's trying to pay it forward so people down the road can have an easier time with these challenging diagnostics.
Yeah. So I guess we know you've written a book, created a monthly newsletter, created a living library and writing incredible articles, but like, what should people know about you as sort of like some baseline information just about Christy?
So I have a career history in, you know, like communications. And so when my life got disrupted by all of this, you know, it sort of hit me first time postpartum when I was, you know, in my early 30s. And, you know, we thought we had it managed. And then like another freight train sort of hit me when I got into a car accident that brought to light that I had cervical instability. And so that led to, oh, okay, well, you definitively have hypermobile EDS. And that led me to, okay, you know, eventually I got to POTS, and then eventually I got to cranial cervical instability, and I've had two fusions to fuse that. So, you know, it's like I've run the gamut of some of the things that can happen to people with EDS. So I try to take that history of what I used to be able to do for work, because I can't work anymore, and put it into something that is like a passionate hobby to try to help other people going through this. And that's where the book was born. And I thought that was going to be the end, but I just keep going and keep going. You know, maybe it's that I like to feel productive, and, you know, chronic illness doesn't really give you a whole lot of sense of value. So this is how I create it for myself.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, you certainly are a great role model for holding it all together when you have all this. So I guess, what if we start by talking about the POTS stuff, and then we'll get into your book and your newsletter and library, because our audience is POTS focused. And you recently wrote an article about how POTS looks a lot like anxiety to somebody who maybe is not an expert. Can you talk about that article? And at some point, I want to get into why you know so much about this, which unfortunately, I think you learned the hard way.
Yeah. This is really one topic I've never talked about, like, publicly. I don't even know that I've had conversations with my loved ones about it. It was just sort of like reflecting back, going, oh, wow, this is what happened, and this is not right. And I need to use the platform to try to share with other people. So, you know, I was thinking about this misdiagnosis maze of, you know, anxiety versus dysautonomia or POTS. And just for simplicity, I'll say POTS, and it's sort of referring to all of that. You know, trying to figure out, is this panic or is this POTS, is really hard. It's hard to know yourself. It's hard for doctors to know. And it's certainly hard to know what to do about it. So, you know, a lot of us are misdiagnosed with a lot of different things, but, you know, this falls into that, you know, being dismissed, gaslit, and, oh, you know, your symptoms are psychosomatic here. Let me give you a pill. And that's really a harmful way to handle a lot of the things that this population is going through. And I went through this personally where, you know, I had tremors and, you know, bad anxiety, heart palpitations, you know, I'm fainting, all the syncope, you know, traditional POTS things. And people started to think I had Parkinson's. You know, so I was going through that kind of gamut of tests, but the psychiatrist thought, you just have, you know, like generalized anxiety disorder, and let's put you on some anxiety meds. And when you don't know, you don't know that they're putting you, you know, I got put on, you know, benzodiazepine, but when they put you on that, I mean, it certainly can calm you down. But when you have POTS, it's not treating the issue of what your symptoms source are coming from. And so I feel like telling this story for me is sort of like coming out as, you know, a former zombie, because I ended up on, if you're familiar with, you know, some of these medications, the typical starting dose is about 0.25 milligrams. And that, you know, like can titrate up to like 0.5, but, you know, typically it's in those low levels. I ended up on 4 milligrams ER every day. And that was because they were like, we can't calm this down. Let's give her some more. Why isn't this working? What's happening? And I was a literal non-thinking, zombified person who I actually have a lot of lack of memory from those years of being in that situation. And it wasn't until I found a really competent, knowledgeable, like neuropsychiatrist that could help me understand the variables or what was going on after I got diagnosed with POTS that was able to go, this is not what you should be on. You know, this is more like a cardiac problem and we need to titrate you down. And that was a horrible process because no one tells you that benzodiazepines are addictive. And so you're going through, I had like a year long withdrawal period that was horrible. And I wouldn't wish that to happen to anybody, particularly when it's not necessary.
A moment ago, you had mentioned for those who are familiar with the anxiety medications or benzodiazepines, but for those of us who are not, what else should we know about those? So like, they're addictive? Were you warned that they would be addictive? What else should people know?
You know, I'm not sure whether it's appropriate for me to name the brand that I was on, but I mean, they are addictive and I was not warned. And I may be simplifying this, but I feel like today, like almost everybody is carrying around some Xanax. You know, it's like, oh, you're stressed today, pop a Xanax. You know, it's become so like culturally normal and acceptable. And I would venture to bet that a lot of people don't recognize how physically addictive that they can be, you know, in the same vein that like opioids are, you know, and I think it's an awareness situation. And, you know, our medical system is so easy to just go, oh, let's put a Band-Aid on the symptom and patch it with a pill.
You know, what's amazing to me is that, for example, in our space, a lot of patients are taking low-dose naltrexone, which is an off-label drug. And a lot of the physicians I know that use it, they make patients sign something that says, I'm aware that this is not a POTS drug. I'm aware that this is off-label, blah, blah, blah. And that's for something that is a like 2% dose of something that sounds super benign to begin with. And yet somehow it seems like benzodiazepines get a pass and they hand them out and they don't give you the warnings that it can be addictive. And I don't know if you've heard any stories like this, but I have heard stories of people who feel like they got their dysautonomia in the first place from the experience of coming off certain types of drugs, maybe too quickly or maybe in a bad way. And it's not just that you had a rough year, you know, there can be lasting effects from that, right?
Yeah. That's tragic. I'm, you know, I haven't heard a lot about that, but you're much more knowledgeable in the dysautonomia world. But, you know, studies are saying that, you know, we're starting to realize that these conditions of, you know, EDS and POTS and mast cell, you know, coexist, or, you know, that they're often found together. You know, there's studies that say 63% of people with hypermobility meet the criterion for anxiety. And my question to that is, well, duh, how can you not have anxiety when you have a dysregulated autonomic nervous system? You know, I mean, if you have instability in your joints, you know, I know particularly with me, it was right here at the base of my skull. And so that causes neurological problems, which, you know, is going to send your body into fight and flight of like, hey, we got problems. You need to do something. I think I'll pass out, you know? And so it's like, well, you know, how do we do this? And then, you know, our population of people deals with a lot of chronic pain. You know, chronic pain impacts you way more than physically. I mean, it's a mental barrier. So this connection of, you know, what I'll call like mental health issues tied to these conditions is kind of like, no, duh.
Well, right? And also in POTS, we know that the brain tends not to be getting enough circulation. And so that increases the fight or flight. And so, of course, anxiety is a part of that. And I just want to be clear that I think we're not saying that there aren't people who would benefit from benzodiazepines as part of their treatment. It's just that when you're mistaking POTS for anxiety and throwing more and more higher doses, like in your case, instead of addressing the underlying problem. Wow. I mean, I'm so happy that you wrote an article to help people figure out when that might be happening, what you can do to prevent it.
Yeah. So think about, you know, why it's just misdiagnosed is, you know, POTS is frequently, you know, put in the same bucket with the symptoms because you have heart palpitations or heart rate, you know, you have dizziness, you have, you know, these other things, like, I don't know about everybody, but, you know, sometimes you can have the shakes or tremors and a lot of these issues and brain fog that, you know, you can't think clearly and your memory's going. And so a lot of that really mimics, it mimics anxiety disorders. And when you recognize that POTS is, you know, not caused by anxiety, but patients that get diagnosed with anxiety, then they have significant delays in diagnosis and treatment for the right thing. You know, and so I think about if I'm sitting around a circle with several of my friends and I ask them, you know, like, okay, let's be open. How many of you have some Xanax in your purse? You know, I would venture to bet that most of them do because it's very common. And then if I asked, you know, my particular group of friends is going to be a lot of people with these conditions because we all, you know, gather together. How many of them got misdiagnosed the first time before they figured out it was POTS? And I'm afraid it's higher than we want to recognize, you know, so I guess I decided to sort of come out in my patient advocacy and talk about this and raise awareness, not only for patients, but for providers, you know, to be able to say, you know, this diagnosis is really complicated and there's a lot of overlap, but there are, you know, diagnostic tests, for example, you know, as your population knows, you know, there's the tilt table test and some things that can help you differentiate these symptoms that can isolate, okay, this is dysautonomia or, you know, this is, you know, anxiety, which I would imagine you're going to have, but you don't get treated for a diagnosis of anxiety. You can get treated as that's a symptom of what's happening with you, but it's not like a root cause and they just throw medication at it because that leads to inappropriate treatment and prolonged suffering. And, you know, in my case, it really impacted the quality of my life. You know, I mean, that doesn't even add to the complications of, you know, particularly women are told that these things are all in their head and they're, you know, dismissed. And then you don't feel like you have the strength or the energy or the, you know, willpower to kind of fight for yourself to say, hang on a minute. This is not just anxiety. There's something else going on here. Can we please keep looking?
And can I ask a question? Like, one thing that comes to mind for me is that when you try a new medication, that's a pretty slow process, right? So like you try the lowest dose and maybe, you know, I don't know how long your doctor wants you to try that before you come back and you say, this isn't working. So they try a higher dose and then you spend, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, who knows how long trying that. Like how much time of yours was wasted on this misdiagnosis going down this path?
Years, many years. You know, I ended up, as I mentioned, you know, I got in the car accident that led me to a physical therapist who, you know, I thought I had whiplash. So, you know, they're handling my head and my neck as I lay on the table to try to evaluate. And, you know, they immediately said, you need to go to the emergency room. And, you know, I'm thinking, why? What's wrong? You know, long story short, you know, you go to the emergency room and they run x-rays and they sent me home saying, oh, just go home and have a glass of wine and get over it. You just are suffering from, you know, muscle pain. Well, it ended up that, you know, I had cranial cervical instability and my, you know, pumpkin sized head was falling off my spine and sliding back more than the, you know, the 5 millimeters that it's supposed to. So obviously there's neurological problems and my body was in, okay, we're in high stress. I'm going to send you every signal I know how to send you, you know, make you pass out, make you vomit, make you nauseous, you know, like walk into walls, you know, you're going to lose your ability to speak. Wow. And so being able to get to the right POTS diagnosis, which thankfully I did when I got, you know, I got diagnosed with hypermobile EDS and that geneticist said, I think you also have dysautonomia. You need to go see, you know, this expert cardiologist. And they do those tests that, you know, we're all familiar with. And, you know, sure enough, I have the hyperadrenalinic POTS, which is, you know, your autonomic system is on total overdrive all the time. Mm-hmm. And so my doctor, my cardiologist, and I worked up a plan to be able to find a way to calm my autonomic nervous system, you know, and that of course meant there were some medications. I mean, you know, whether it was beta blockers or, you know, other things, and there's so many that, you know, different recipes of what works for POTS patients, but a lot of it was me and lifestyle daily habits of learning how to calm. And it started with using like the Calm app and meditating, which I didn't even know how to do, you know, 6, 7, 8 times a day for like a year to try to get my heart rate that was in the 150s laying down at rest.
Wow.
And now it's in the 50s and 60s when I'm walking around. I mean, wow. So it was really retraining all that overactive stuff through biofeedback and, you know, literally everything I could do to just change my environment and my internal talking, you know, brain to my body and everything else to go, hey guys, we got to calm down. Because the cardiologist told me, you're not going to make it to your next birthday when I was 48. So I was highly motivated.
Wow. Is there anything else in this article that you want to highlight? And we'll link to it in the show notes, but maybe you can mention where people can find it.
Yeah, so we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's part of some content that I help create for an EDS nonprofit called Chronic Pain Partners. And so it's on their website. But what I really want to share with your audience is some tips to know the difference between anxiety and POTS. So we all know postural changes are a big thing that impacts people with dysautonomia. And, you know, it's the symptom that flares up when you change positions, like standing up. Well, that's not a symptom that happens with anxiety. The second one is, you know, when you're using your heart rate monitor, it can be an invaluable tool to be able not only to track your heart rate, like from lying down to standing up. And as you know, if it goes up by more than 30 beats per minute in those, you know, first few minutes after standing, that's indicative of POTS. And I think people can do this sort of at home, you know, tilt table test without having to go through that torture.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, poor man's test or a Nassalene test. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's another sign. That's not anxiety. And, you know, anxiety can kind of come and go inconsistently, and it can have triggers that are often like a stressor or an emotional situation. And POTS symptoms are much more consistent. They're tied to that physical location, exertion, much less than emotional stress. I mean, they can all go together, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I have to laugh because I'm remembering a patient who once told me a story that she figured out the difference between POTS symptoms and anxiety symptoms, because what she would do would be to eat her favorite carby snack. And when it would calm her down, she knew it was anxiety she was feeling. And when it would make it worse, she knew it was POTS she was feeling, because eating carbs can make POTS worse. But it makes
that's
anxiety
really interesting.
At least her better.
That's interesting, you know, because I've always been hypoglycemic. And so, you know, I monitor my carbs. And you're right, that I hadn't thought about that. That's a pretty interesting way to do your at-home test.
Not official, but it worked for her.
Right, right. I mean, you know, like figuring out the blood pooling, you know, anxiety doesn't cause that. Your ankles don't swell and turn purple. But, you know, it's also, there's obviously, you know, medical tests and EKGs and all these things that are not part of a standard psychological evaluation that, you know, maybe you should see a cardiologist who understands this and, you know, a psychologist or psychiatrist who understands the sort of mental part of this to try to discern these symptoms, you know, to have a compare and contrast of, okay, it's more like this. And that might be a way to kind of combat, you know, this misdiagnosis that might help both patients and healthcare providers. You know, they're all there to help people. They don't want to misdiagnose. They're just doing the best they can with this volumes of data they carry around in their brain about how to cross-reference what causes this. I mean, it's a job that I could not do. I mean, you know, thank goodness for medical professionals, but it can go the wrong way for some patients. And unfortunately for patients like me, you know, you get caught up in benzodiazepines, which are, you know, sedation and fatigue and blood pressure and heart, you know, all these sort of inappropriate adverse reactions. So what I would say is anybody who feels like their symptoms are like maybe wrongly attributed to anxiety, you know, trust your instincts. And if what you're experiencing doesn't really align with, you know, what you're reading about the symptoms of anxiety, maybe go Google the symptoms of POTS and see if some of that lines up better, and have those conversations with your care providers. And yes, I understand that, you know, maybe if you go to your GP, they might not have a knowledge of this. So see if you can find, you know, a POTS aware cardiologist in your area, or, you know, have a virtual online evaluation with one of the experts that you maybe wouldn't have to travel to.
Gosh, you know what you're making me so curious to know is if we took 1,000 anxiety patients, and maybe we would target the demographic that tends to get POTS, I wonder how many anxiety patients we'd find with POTS. Because, you know, it seems like in the POTS and EDS and triad world, people notice that the patients here tend to be almost of a type, kind of like high achievers. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it's because it takes a certain amount of work, persistence, and self-confidence to keep fighting to get that POTS diagnosis when there is a strong trend to get an anxiety diagnosis first. And I wonder how many people give into that and are in the anxiety world wondering why their medications don't work.
You know, that's really interesting. I found some study information that, you know, like, okay, 50% of people with EDS have POTS, and, you know, they're studying all the neurodivergent and neurological impacts that come along with this, you know, so they're finding that, you know, in pediatrics, 32% of kids that have EDS also have things like ADHD. And then Sweden, the largest study that they did to date in 2016, which I love the term that they use, the patient population that has an increased disease load.
Lovely.
That, you know, people with hypermobile EDS or hypermobility are 7 times more likely to have autism.
Wow.
And, you know, like 5 times more likely to have depression or bipolar disorder. So it's like, you know, there's definitively an autonomic neurological neuromuscular component that ties these together. And I don't think there's just been enough studies. Like you said, how many people with POTS have anxiety? But, you know, I'm really glad this can sound kind of strange, but as a result of the pandemic, dysautonomia and POTS are finally getting some much overdue attention, both in media articles and awareness and recognition, and then, of course, in funding and future medical research, which is fantastic. I'm sorry that it took a global pandemic for something like that to happen and all of those, you know, lives lost. But the amount of funding that's going into this onset of long COVID is huge and about time, because, you know, these are symptoms that didn't start with the pandemic. There have been people like you and I that have had it for many years before that, but now there's becoming a better awareness. And so medical training is talking about it and that, you know, connection between the autonomic nervous system and, you know, the heart and some of these systemic things that are not just like a siloed specialist are getting talked about and researched. And I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. And we haven't mentioned mast cell activation syndrome yet, but we know that that can be part of the package and that can also create inflammation in the brain, which theoretically may contribute to some neuropsychiatric symptoms. And there's some great research going on with that right now that hopefully will come out before too long. But it all gets back to what you were saying about this increased disease load. And there's a lot of things to look at before you just throw benzodiazepines at the problem. And so I really appreciate that you are coming forward to talk about this issue. And I'm sorry that the world makes you feel like
ashamed.
Yeah. For all you've done, a best-selling author doing all this incredible nonprofit work. And the fact that you said you haven't even talked to this with a lot of your loved ones is, you know, anyway, thank you.
I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons that that's really hard. I mean, you know, we live in a hyper digital go gadget society that rewards, you know, success as, okay, you worked more hours than I did. Oh, I have more emails in my inbox than you do. You know, I mean, it's like this quirky sort of system of, you know, approvals and who's successful based on what, you know, but we have to be in demand of ways to differentiate, you know, what's quote unquote normal and what's problematic anxiety, like someone with a mental health issue who the anxiety itself is causing them to be, you know, not able to function in their life, as opposed to something else, a differential diagnosis. And, you know, this gets really complex, but I just think that people need to be more aware to just keep digging, look a little further. And, you know, this misdiagnosis maze can maybe become a little less common.
Amen. So, you know, what's funny is, you know, you talk about we live in a go, go, go world, and you have done a fair bit of go, go, going, even despite having a lot of issues. Let's talk about some of the other stuff you've done and where people can find it. Where do you want to start with? Your book?
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share, you know, it's not like a book plug, but it's more like if there's a resource out there that can help a family get through this challenging time, because when you get diagnosed with EDS or POTS or mast cell, you're just lost. And it takes years to become more aware, learn about it. And, you know, and all the while you're going through like a mental health crisis of your life got turned upside down by a chronic illness that maybe stopped your work, stopped, you know, your ability to function or drive or, you know, whatever it is. And so what I tried to do was recount in my book, Holding It All Together When You're Hypermobile, of my personal story of kind of how it hit the fan and then what I did about it and the good outcomes of what I call healing habits that I could do. And it was a holistic look of, okay, obviously there's medications. I mean, you know, POTS needs, you know, beta blockers and such, but there are a lot of things that you have control over, like learning how to do deep breathing to calm your autonomic nervous system, or, you know, learning to prioritize your own self-care, which is incredibly hard for women in particular, who are the caregivers, or even learning to prioritize and value restorative rest. I mean, how guilty do all of us feel when we're sitting around unproductive and like, oh, I need to take a nap? It's like your body is telling you something. We need to learn how to listen to those cues, right? So that's what I tried to do with my book. And I had absolutely no idea it was going to go gangbusters. I announced it, and within, you know, like 24 hours, it was hitting the Amazon bestseller, you know, algorithm. And I was like, what? It has nothing to do with me or my writing or the story within. It's the demand and the lack of information and resources that all of these people that are suffering with these things are starving for, and they don't know where to go, you know?
Well, you're also an incredible writer, and so I think we shouldn't sell you short. But yeah, it's a wonderful book, and it's full of so many practical tips coming from someone that you can tell has been there and cares.
I mean, that's what I try to do. That's kind of my personal mantra. Is in my former career, I used to write about technology. And like my expertise was taking a lot of complex information and boiling it down to something that was simple that our clients could understand. Like, for example, explaining the cloud when all that first happened. I mean, it was very hard to explain what that was. And I sort of treat this similarly. It's like, go research, find all this information and sort of boil it down to, okay, this is the need to know. This is the things you can do about it, because you can get flooded with so much information and weeding through that you're overwhelmed, and that makes it worse. So it's like, let's try to simplify this into actionable, practical tips or referrals to this app or this book or this podcast. You know, it's like there's help out there and you can help yourself. So that's kind of how I approach it in the things that I write or share.
Awesome. Okay. And then after you wrote the book, you created edsshare.com, the monthly newsletter. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So as you're like me, you're doing all this research, you're trying to figure out these answers to help yourself or your loved ones or your child who has these conditions. So you amass this great, you know, library of data. And I tried to kind of like summarize things and write articles. And so that started a subscription to an e-newsletter of, you know, I started it with what I called the top five and one deep dive, which was just like a list of five things of like, here's a cool app to try, or here's a, you know, a product that is helpful with pain relief. And, you know, it was just that. And then I would do a deep dive into some research topic, and I was getting positive response and people liking the information. So it just kind of grew and grew. And now I have several thousand subscribers, and, you know, they're a devoted audience counting on that information. And so what happened, to be totally honest, was I had so much data that I couldn't keep it organized, you know, brain fog and all the other things. So I started a mechanism to try to organize it kind of like in a Google sheet, like, you know, let's make a spreadsheet of the, you know, the things that I've either written or the resources that I think are really valuable that I found. And so I ended up amassing this spreadsheet with thousands and thousands of things in it. And I realized this is so well beyond a book. I have to find a way to put this out there so that others can have an easy search. So with some technology help and some people that were able to help me sort of put it together, I built what I call the EDS 411 Living Library. And what it is it's kind of like just like a simple resource hub of hyperlinks of things that are everything from different categories of like research or news media articles or, you know, helpful products or a video from so-and-so doctor talking about, you know, XYZ. So I've amassed this thing that has like nearly 5,000 entries in it, and I created it into an app and a tool that makes it searchable by keyword or by category. And then also has this other feature that I'm excited about because it's designed by the community for the community. And people have been contributing to these articles for many years. And so there's a way that you can go onto the app and upvote like, okay, I found this like super helpful, so that over time, it's going to become like the cream is going to rise to the top of what the patient community thinks is the most valuable good information. And I just launched it earlier this summer, and anyone can access it. It's free, share it widely. If you go to app.eds411.com.
I'll put it in the show notes if people want a link.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's an overwhelming amount of information, but if you want to go in there and say you're going to search on, you know, syncope, it's going to pull up all of the articles and information that have that word in the content, which is a great tool because you might find answers faster, which is what I believe we all need to be able to get to diagnosis faster, to get to better treatment faster, and to get to improving the quality of our lives.
Absolutely. What I love about the feature that you mentioned with the cream rising is that it lets all the patients participate in the larger mission that you have, which is getting people answers faster so that they can get back to their lives faster. And I'm really sorry that it sounds like a few years of your life was kind of taken from you. Like you said, where you're a zombie. And I can't imagine what that's like to not have memories from a few years of your life. But I'm so impressed that you have taken that experience and decided to use it to make things better for everybody who comes after you. I mean, I just love that. That's beautiful. And thank you from the whole community.
Yeah. You know, what they say, how I feel is, you know, when I wrote my book, it was like, if this helps one person, then it's worth it. And so if I'm beyond the one person, then that's phenomenal. I'm so pleased. You know, it's never about money. When you write a book, you're not making money. I mean, you know, it's not about any of that. It's about, I hope that my grandchildren have a better time navigating this life and being able to make decisions earlier on because they got a better diagnosis and they could work in a particular kind of job that facilitated accommodations, etc., so that they could succeed and have a better quality of life.
That's beautiful. Well, Christy Cox, author, advocate, fellow patient, we thank you so much for everything you've done and for sharing your story and all your great information today. Is there anything else you wanted to share with our audience?
I thank you for all the work you're doing. And I hope that, you know, sharing this can bring a shift to the narrative from like, it's all in your head, to more about, it's all about understanding this head and heart connection.
Beautiful. Well, again, thank you so much, Christy. And hey, listeners, that's all for today. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. We'll be back again next week. But until then, thank you for listening. Remember, you're not alone. And please join us again soon.
As a reminder, anything you hear on this podcast is not medical advice. Consult your healthcare team about what's right for you. This show is a production of Standing Up to POTS, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You can send us feedback or make a tax-deductible donation at www.standinguptopots.org. You can also engage with us on social media at the handle Standing Up to Pots. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing to our podcast and sharing it with your friends and family. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at www.thepotscast.com. Thanks for listening.